This is FSNN reporter MJ Del Valle in Tbilisi, Georgia. Free Speech Radio News has been an essential outlet for my stories from the Caucasus region, including in-depth looks at the recent Armenian presidential election, the creative ways protesters in Azerbaijan are using to fight for freedom of expression and labor struggles in the Republic of Georgia. But FSRN, along with the voices of people struggling for dignity, equality, and human rights, could be silenced. Find out how can you support independent grassroots journalists at fsrn.org.
This is Radio Anguindian. Anguindian Radio for the Fourth World.
You are listening to the Angry and Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
We're still on the line with Mathematic. You can check out his work at Mathematic on Twitter, at Mathematic. And we'll put the address with the dispatch and the other data that goes along with this show. So, you know, we've been talking about Ferguson. We've been talking about communities not really having control over what happens in their own environments. And we don't look at nutrition and we don't look at cooperative businesses when we discuss that, because one of the things about capitalism is that it's a bloodsucker. All right? You know, the whole point about capitalism is to maximize capital, exploitation. That's the root of it. Now, I've had crawls with I don't know how many goddamn Republicans and hardcore laissez-faire capitalists, but it always comes down to the same thing. They can never explain to me, in logical, rational terms, why exploiting other human beings, exploiting the environment, exploiting the animal life, exploiting everything, space. They're looking at space right now. If you just saw what happened, you know, the private company is kind of upset right now because their little space program didn't make it, right? So, you know, they want to privatize every goddamn thing. So, you know, they would sell you air if they could. And they, in the 50s, they were actually trying to figure that out. So, you know, when it comes to being able to survive as whole people, as whole human beings, we need to start looking at the alternatives. Now, the cooperative is not a new thing. The cooperative is actually quite an American thing. You know, it's one of the few things, like, you know, American anarchism that's actually homegrown from the Eurosettler population, and the idea of everyone in the community having equal share to the store. But of course, we know that they got that information from natives. You know, we talk about potlatch and what have you. Mm-hmm. You know, we understand that, and we can talk about that too. But right now, you know, if you can, and take all the time you need, please explain what is the basis of a cooperative and how that relates to food cooperatives and how that relates to, you know, basically, you know, in what it should be doing in most cases, lowering prices, but at the same time providing a healthy, you know, much more personal relationship between you and your provider than, say, what you get in any, you know, name any brand, multi-state, you know, supermarket chain.
Well, the foundation of a cooperative is that it is a for-profit enterprise that is owned by the community that it serves. And what that means is, instead of it being a, you know, stock corporation or a privately owned corporation that's run by some family, it's instead owned by members, and members constitute the community. So it creates is a democratically run, profit-driven business, and that's a huge difference to you know, top-down, basically dictator-run businesses that most capitalist businesses are. So, a cooperative is organized by a group of people, and they share a equal share in that business. So the profits, instead of being siphoned off to somebody who owns them on Wall Street, and then the goals of the business being guided by those very same people who just want to see profits go to them directly. It instead is guided by the locals who work at the business, who frequent the business, who their customers are. And the profits are returned in ways, sometimes they're called patronage rebates. REI, the Campers outfit, is probably the most well-known cooperative out there. That is a true cooperative. You can become a member. You pay an annual fee, and you will get a patronage rebate. If you shop there, you get a very significant patronage rebate right around Christmas time. I believe it's they give back as much as 5-10% of their sales go right back to the members, and you're able to shop even more with that, essentially free money. And you find that concept at almost every cooperative. Not all of them have a patronage rebate, but most do. Where this relates to food justice, I think, to take this a little bit further back, a lot of people talk about the 60s and the, revolutions that took place then, civil rights, and a lot of other important progressive changes in our society. And then they, a lot of people say that we never finished the job, or that, it's still an ongoing struggle, which I recognize that to be the case, especially when it comes to civil rights. But also from the 60s, what was born was the modern food cooperative movement, where, people were starting to see the effects of too much pesticides on their food. And there was absolutely no supply for a clean food movement. You fast forward the 40, 50 years since, now the National Cooperative Grocers Association, which is the umbrella organization that almost all food co-ops have banded together to form, that organization, buys close to $3 billion worth of product every year. So in many ways, what was born out of the strife of the 60s in terms of food justice has really grown up and is a huge industry. And without the food co-ops, I don't think you would have this large natural products industry, dominated by Whole Foods Market and UNFI, and then other big players like them. I think a lot of us need to kind of recognize that, starting a small seed of an idea, fast forward 50 years, it could mean, $3 billion worth of change, which you have every single year when the National Cooperative Grocers Association, with all those food co-ops, buying this now clean food that's readily available, funneling it to all these communities across the United States. That's what was born out of a very simple idea of just giving community ownership to your grocery store, is now this humongous business. So there's a couple of case studies that I think would help explain food co-ops right in my neighborhood, actually. I live in College Park, Maryland, and right nearby there's two food co-ops that are just perfect examples for anybody who's wanting to start one in their community or wanting their food co-op to function better. The first one would be Greenbelt Co-op. And Greenbelt Co-op is very interesting because it's not actually a natural products cooperative. They sell conventional groceries. They do have organic produce and organic options, but it's very similar to what you would find at a conventional grocery store. And what that means is a lot of people are very familiar with the products already. So it's very easy for people to buy into that co-op because it's the same products you would buy at any other grocery store. So they are very successful. You know, they have a patronage rebate. They return, you know, if you're buying groceries there every week, you're going to get back several hundred dollars in a patronage rebate, which will probably pay for about 2 weeks of groceries. And on top of it, they also operate a pharmacy, and their pharmacy has the lowest prices on medicine out of any pharmacy nearby. They beat CVS. They beat, you know, every player in the pharmacy field. And, you know, so I think they're a very interesting case study in what, you know, maybe you don't believe in organic food, but you see a need for a grocery store in your neighborhood. You see a need for a grocery store to employ people and give jobs to people. Then, you know, look at the Greenbelt Cooperative, because that's exactly what they've done. And on top of the Greenbelt Cooperative, that town is actually a cooperative town. The apartments are all owned in a cooperative way. And when you buy an apartment in their community, you're buying into a business that actually owns the entire community. So it helps ensure, you know, democratic decisions are made locally. You know, we elect our leaders and every election day, but is their job dependent on us? You know, are they waiting for our money? Are we paying their salary and improvements somewhere? You don't have to start, you know, some sort of voting initiative. All you have to do is talk to the other people that live there and they're members of the co-op too, and you can get issues put on the next meeting. And, you know, and you can ensure that those issues are dealt with. And if not, you can run to be board president yourself. You know, it's a very different community in that way. And I think it's incredibly successful. And if anybody's interested in learning more about co-ops, housing cooperatives, food co-ops, definitely research Greenbelt, Maryland. And then the other case study, it's also nearby. It's in Mount Rainier, Maryland, which is right outside of D.C. It's an old trolley car suburb of D.C. And the food co-op there is called Glut Food Co-op. And Glut Food Co-op is what's called an employee-owned co-op. So it's not technically owned by the members and the customers. It's owned by the people that work there, which is, you know, an interesting take on the cooperative, and I think very important for communities that are more focused on wanting to, you know, grow wealth in their neighborhood. Glut does that to a T. The people that work there are well paid. They're, you know, they're probably paid twice, maybe three times as much as minimum wage.
Now, let me ask you a quick question as far as the business model. How would you relate the average food co-op? How would you relate the average food co-op in North America, and particularly in the United States, as opposed to, say, Costco, which sells name brand items, doesn't sell food, you know, carries hard items, medicines, and so on, that the average food co-op would not carry, in terms of where the public should actually decide to put their money, and what sort of businesses we should start demanding as consumers?
Yeah, I think that there's a huge opportunity for co-ops to enter almost any business sector. Take on places like Target, take on places like Costco. A lot of times those places are fake cooperatives where they charge you a membership fee, and, you know, in order to get in the door to get discounts. But, you know, aside from getting the discount, you don't get any value returned, and you definitely don't get decision-making authority. You know, you're not going to elect the board president who's going to hire the CEO of the company. So, you know, to take this a little bit to the theoretical, I'm actually seeing the biggest opportunity being online businesses. for cooperatives. And the reason being, I think we're reaching a point of awareness where people are tired of the old advertising-driven model of, you know, social networks like Facebook, Twitter, and then also that, you know, our data is their product, and that's what their business model is driven on. So, you know, just by using their services, we're agreeing to towards running a social media company. Because they, you know, they would be more focused on ensuring what the members, you know, the people that use the service want more than anybody. And almost every single social network company out there is following along these lines of, you know, advertising and then selling your data. So that would be the place where I would actually see potential innovation in the cooperative model, if somebody could tie it into social media and help guarantee people's privacy and safety, you know, online. And to get back real quick on the Glut Food Co-op, that co-op is most remarkable because from my research, which is not, you know, complete, but I don't think there's another food co-op who has as much participation from their African-American community. You know, the majority of the employees there are African-American. The majority of the shoppers there are African-American. And it's an organic food co-op. You know, they carry natural products. They don't carry Coca-Cola. You know, they don't carry, you know, Life cereal. You go in there, you know, you're going to, you know, get the natural versions of everything, you know, and yet still they've been incredibly successful, and they just continually grow their shopping base and their employees. So if there's people who find themselves in a food desert, you know, there's food deserts all over the place, Southeast DC, even Northeast DC could be described as such. And the places where people cannot get easy access to a grocery store, or the grocery store that they even have access to is, you know, full of frozen unhealthy food like Aldi, you know, if you want to really have a positive change in your community, look at Glut Food Co-op in Mount Rainier, Maryland. Look at Greenbelt Cooperative in Greenbelt, Maryland, and start trying to organize along those models.
Why cooperatives in the U.S. are not like their European counterparts or the counterparts in South America? I don't really have the story on Asia. And Africa is just a non-existent concept, other than how smaller communities, usually on tribal affiliations, do the same thing. But in terms of commerce, they really, you know, it's just not, the concept just doesn't exist. But in the States, for whatever reason, there seems to be this willingness to not get up to speed, to get up to date with technological advances that could make accounting, that could make valuation, that simply could make running the store, running the cashiers, you know, running the POS system, running your inventory. I mean, when I worked in retail, I hated having to do inventory. And it's a hell of a lot easier now than it used to be. But, you know, we're noticing that a lot of cooperatives simply do not want to step up to a lot of these things. There's a lack of willingness to modernize. What do you think that's about?
Yeah, I think it's mainly because, for some reason, in my experience, it's very difficult to get a committee of people to all recognize the need for innovation, the need to challenge and take risks. And I think that is one of the things that may be sacrificed when you switch from like a capitalist model to a cooperative one. And that being said, it's only because most cooperatives are focused on stability. So they're not trying to, you know, bet the farm on the next big thing. You know, they might have had experience in the past where they bought a new system and it didn't integrate properly and they were out that money, you know, instead of being able to return that money back to their membership. And a lot of times that, you know, they remember those experiences and instead they get very, you know, steadfast in place and really don't innovate as much as they should. And it's mostly because they're focused on stability and ensuring that there's absolutely no chance they're going to go out of business. But as we all know, a business that over-focuses on stability is doomed to die. If you're not constantly reinventing your business, at some point, a better player is going to come into your turf, you know, and take over your customers. So I would agree with them that I have also found a lack of innovation across the board from cooperatives. But in the same token, there is a lot of people that are pushing for that to change. I'm definitely one of them. You know, for credit unions, there's creditunions.com. And, you know, those people are constantly pushing to innovate in the credit union industry. You know, which is even bigger than the food co-op industry. You know, when we're talking like hundreds of billions of dollars in wealth being held by cooperative banks in this country. So there are people that are pushing the envelope. And then on the food co-op side, I do it myself as much as possible. And there is food co-ops out there that see the need to grow, change, and take on new technology and new processes. And the best case study for that would be MountainViewMarket.coop. Mountain View Market is a food co-op in Las Cruces, New Mexico. They were founded by university students over 30 years ago. I think 35 years ago they were founded. And now, you know, they're a multi-million dollar operation. They employ, you know, about 50 employees. They pay what's called a living wage. And the living wage equals, you know, closer to $11.50 an hour. So already higher than the proposed minimum wage. And every year they raise it.
From the management's perspective, if I want my people to perform, I have to give them the data so that they can do their jobs. And I have to trust them that they're going to do their jobs. You know, I mean, is it a matter of how they run these systems, you know, that allows them to function? Because the European cooperatives, they have problems, you know, but it seems to be that's not one of the problems that they really are dealing with, from what I'm reading.
Yeah. Yeah, I think in terms of what Mountain View Market does, I know they have an open book management policy where all budgets are open for review by anybody, publicly in the organization, by the board. And that definitely helps them, you know, create this culture where one of the main values for that co-op is to ensure that the employees are paid well. And the other thing that is very different about them, their board of directors and then also their general manager are true visionaries. You know, they see themselves existing in Las Cruces, the marketplace, which, you know, if you count everybody that lives around it, only is 120,000 people. And when, you know, they reached a point in their growth where it was time to expand, they did a lot of research and study and decided if they opened up another food co-op right away, all it really would do would just decrease the sales at their first one, and not necessarily deliver that much more value to the community because it's already a pretty centralized city, small city. So instead, they invested in more lateral moves. The first one being a community farm, where they own and operate a farm just outside of town in Mesilla, New Mexico, that, you know, has 35 chickens. They have an aquaponics system where they're able to use fish, in this case koi, to fertilize the water that then they grow fresh vegetables on. You know, they have because they're in the middle of a desert. They are a literal food desert. You know, they are in the Chihuahuan Desert. And the conditions they face are different than most average organic farms. So, you know, they divert their cardboard. It doesn't all go back to manufacturer. A lot of cardboard recycling happens at grocery stores, and that's another revenue source. A lot of grocery stores are paid for their cardboard. So they actually divert the cleanest cardboard and then mix it with the scraps from their food prep, and they create their own compost with it. They also use vermiculture, which is worms, in the process of composting. So they're able to break down, you know, these, you know, food and cardboard scraps into arable land in a matter of a month and a half, which is just, you know, typically decomposition takes like 3 to 6 months. So they're creating their own soil in the desert to grow organic food on. And they're switching to a nonprofit. It's a separate business entity. They're going to go nonprofit for that, which is going to allow them access to grants to help, improve their systems there. And in many ways, they've just really become an education system for how to operate an organic farm in the desert. And then on top of it, they're able to not have a middleman. They cut out the middleman. So that's one of the ways that they're able to pay a little bit better than some other food co-ops. A lot of their produce is coming in local and organic from their own farm. It's an interesting concept. One of the ways that they're able to get better value. It's been about a 3-year effort for the website. And looking back on it, it's helping create another sales channel that wasn't there originally. And most importantly, what it did is it made them aware of El Paso, Texas, and their needs. El Paso and Las Cruces are really the same metro area. They share an airport, even though, you know, it's two different states. They border Juarez, Mexico. So El Paso, Texas, you're talking about 655,000 people living just in the city, not counting the suburbs. And then in Juarez, there's over 2 million people. It's actually one of the biggest metro areas in the continent, if you include those three cities together. And what happened was there's this, the El Paso community started ordering through the website, you know, on a huge scale, about three times as often as anybody local in Las Cruces. And then they decided to kind of follow that interest, and they started their own farmers market in El Paso, just outside of El Paso. They kind of used the geography to their advantage. They started they joined a farmers market in the Desert Sunland Park, New Mexico, at this place called Desert Crossing Farmers Market, which allows them to not have to create a Texas business entity and yet still serve people that live in El Paso. And El Paso, despite being a much bigger city, they do not have a food co-op. And El Paso only has one or two options. You know, they have a Sprouts, natural foods there, And then there's a very, very small independent natural food store on the east side. But otherwise, there's nowhere to buy, you know, from a strict natural products grocery store. So what's actually happening now, there's a huge movement growing to bring Mountain View Market to El Paso. And it all ties into their website and looking at who was visiting and who was ordering. And, you know, what they decided to do was start serving those people because they were only 45 minutes away. So the people that live in Las Cruces can go into their food co-op and choose from, you know, amazing organic groceries and bulk groceries and tons of choice. And then if you live in El Paso, you can order through mountainviewmarket.coop and pick up for free at Artavino's Desert Crossing in Sunland Park, New Mexico, every Saturday morning. So they extended an olive branch, you know, a fig leaf, whatever you want to call it, to that community, and it's being well received. You know, they just did a El Paso as a cultivate forum, which is people that are trying to bring more sustainable business practices to the food industry in El Paso. And they invited the general manager, Shahid Mustafa, of Mountain View Market.coop to speak there. And, you know, there was like close to 200 people. You know, that's the level of interest they have to change their community. And, you know, that's just one of the stories of what, you know, and again, it all hinges on this very special, unique food co-op that kind of recognizes that they had to be innovative in their growth, or else they were just gonna, you know, suffer. If they were gonna open a Mountain View Market location in El Paso, and it's all because of how visionary that food co-op really is, and that people there, you know, are willing to take some risk to ensure that their business is gonna be in place.
Well, I mean,
20,
it seems to me that they were moving away mentally in how they were dealing on their board of directors, how they were dealing with their upper management, and, you know, perhaps maybe listening to their employees and to their member owners, that they thought, you know, as you said, they moved laterally. They moved into a way that benefits the entity, that benefits the concept, rather than, okay, well, this is what capitalism does. We have one successful store, so we're going to open another. And squandering their resources when they could have been developing something new and moving in a different direction. Now, one of the last things I wanted to ask you, though, because you do come from the tech side, and, you know, we listen to internationally, and like I said, there are people who work in the industry that do pay attention to the show that have been asking me to get somebody like you on for some time, and I've been having a lot of difficulty in that. So, you know, being that you do have your experience, you know, what would you like to say to those who are working in the food co-op industry, who shop at co-ops, and, you know, what they can do to actually, you know, step up their game? And really make the inroads, because, you know, we're here on the West Coast and in the Pacific Northwest, we're dealing with QFC, we're dealing with Starbucks, we're dealing with Albertsons. We have, as I mentioned, Eric Prince earlier, Boathouse Farms. You know, Walmart is getting a lot of credit for their organic produce section, for their organic meats and fish because of their choices. But they're a big, you know, monstrosity of a business. This is not local. You know, like when I go to my local supermarket, they talk local. And I can ask them, what's local? They mean the entire side of the country, you know. They're not at all. Whereas I can go to my local food co-op and I can ask them, what farm does this come from? And they can tell me. Some of them, you know, they can say, well, I actually know the farmer personally. He comes in a couple times a week. And you know, is there something you'd like me to ask, or would you like me to pass something on? I've had these conversations. This is something you will not get, even in a Whole Foods, which you know, really has pulled the wool over a lot of people's eyes in terms of, you know, okay, that's one thing I can ask you when you give me your answer. You know, there are so many people who do not go to food co-ops because they think that they're elitist. You know, you have a membership fee. It's not like going to the QFC or whatever, and you just buy your stuff and you leave. There's a membership fee. A lot of people are wearing Crocs, right? You know, there's a lot of tattooed women and pink hair. You know, what is it about the culture of cooperatives that you think keeps a lot of mainstream people away from cooperatives? Is it a fear of tofu? You know, what is it?
I think that more of a fear of natural products, and really it's that natural products just haven't been around long enough to establish the same sort of brand awareness, and they haven't been traditional advertisers. You know, they didn't go and sponsor world tours of famous musicians. You know, they're not wasting their money on that stuff. They're spending their money wisely on better, you know, products and methods. You know, every time you go and you decide to purchase a conventional brand, you know, understand, you know, some people's criticisms. And I think what people don't always grasp is that the co-op itself is made up of members just like you. If you see criticism of their organization, there's a very easy avenue to take. You know, you become a member, you start petitioning the board to put issues on the ballot, you start becoming a more influential member by, you know, lending yourself for causes, helping support them, ensuring that you're buying. You know, it's very important to keep buying through them and talking with your dollars more than anything. But eventually, you could easily run for the board. You know, a lot of these boards, Mountain View Market has a lot of votes cast in their elections. Most food co-op boards, that's not the case. You know, you're talking people are winning with like maybe 30 votes. So, you know, it's easier to take over if you're interested. If you think that a food co-op is not doing right by the community.
This idea that cooperatives are political, but they're not political. Okay, like they're political against China. They're political against Coca-Cola, but they're not political in terms of the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movements against the the oppression of Palestinians within the state of Israel. We have one cooperative in the Pacific Northwest, the Olympia, or the co-op. Well, yeah, the Olympia Co-op. I believe that's what it is. It's in Olympia, Washington. In Washington State, and they have been, as far as I understand, the only cooperative in the United States that is honoring the boycott. And they put up with a fair amount of stress, but they've maintained their position, and they seem to have gotten more respect because of this. They only lost, as they say, a marginal amount of business. They said so marginal that after, you know, a year or so, they couldn't even account for it. There was another move in terms of another cooperative in Washington State, and that failed. Not really sure how that worked out, but I believe the board of directors decided to simply not make a decision. So this way, they didn't have to make a decision. But one of the things I want to point out about this, that particular case, is that it was relayed to me that the local big business supermarkets, QFC and Safeway, respectively, because they're very popular here, or they're very, you know, established here on the West Coast, in the Pacific Northwest, and they decided that they were going to step up their, in other words, when you go into a Safeway on the West Coast, many of the ethnically Jewish items, matzah balls, gefilte fish, you know, that sort of thing, is in a specific aisle, right? It's not with the other ethnic groups. It's not with the Mexican. It's not with the Asian, with the ramen, that sort of thing. It has its own section. And I was told that when this particular cooperative was making that decision, because Ali Abanima went up to the area and spoke, and someone was shipped in from San Francisco to debate him. I mean, those of you who follow Ali Abanima, and just like it sounds, Ali Abanima, he's on Twitter, @ Ali Abanima, obviously on Twitter. you know, I can't. I just remember that there was a big debate about this. It was held at a local church, and they ended up after this not holding any kind of a vote, nothing. And you know, where are cooperatives when it comes to political activism? You know, is it political or is it hypocritical to say take a stand against you know, like China, which is easy to hate, as opposed to what's going on in Palestine, which, you know, in terms of human rights is, you know, it is what it is. You know, where are cooperatives in terms of their business models, where they make these decisions, in terms of where they make stances, as opposed to, say, public pressure against a Walmart for their business practices in China, or even a Costco, where you have a membership and some of the products that they may carry?
Well, there's probably about three causes that I know have come up across many co-ops and other natural food stores. The first one was, you know, to boycott Israeli-made goods and prevent them from being sold. The next one that actually came up was around the GMO vote in California and what companies that are natural products companies, but, you know, either donated directly or their owning company, their mother company, whatever you want to call it, donated directly to squash the GMO labeling campaign. And another one that came up more recently was with the female contraceptive, you know, Supreme Court decision, where employers were allowed to deny women access through their medical plans, employer-run medical plans, access to certain contraceptives. That was another one that came up for, I think it was Eden Foods. So, you know, these issues come up once, twice, three times a year. And in the end, it's really up to the, you know, whoever's vocal about it to ensure that it gets put on the ballot. And I am aware
there has been
breakdowns in the model where, you know, certain voices and opinions were basically left out, where things were not put up to votes. And, you know, there, in the end, the ultimate accountability lies with the membership. If the membership is truly for these causes, then they would happen. You know, if the membership was bothering the people that run the co-op and the board of directors enough, they would happen. And if they didn't happen, then it was the obligation of the membership to replace those people, which is all very possible. So I think, too, when you look at these kinds of cases, the unfortunate thing is, you know, a lot of people in business, they, you know, they don't feel it's their job to censor and to control access at all times. And when you start, you know, natural products, the unfortunate thing is there isn't thousands and thousands of options for certain items. You know, I think there's an Israeli operated, and I remember that was one of the big products that was, you know, trying to be blocked. And the unfortunate thing is that there was no other option out there. If, you know, if this product was selling well and it was then going to be boycotted, there was nothing to fill its place. And then, you know, you're asking the people that operate the business to actually take financial losses and financial hits for these causes, you know, $5,000 a year on this product, whatever it might be. and we're willing to sacrifice that. You know, and if there is anybody out there that has felt slighted by the food co-op, you know, reach out to me on Twitter because I can help you organize ways of getting through. And again, I think you, part of the problem with people's understanding of food co-ops, there isn't tons of profit to go around. You're operating on the thinnest of margins. If you can return a profit of 1.5 to 3% every year, you are an extremely successful grocery store business. So, you know, other grocery stores that are privately operated that have somehow been able to negotiate terrible, you know, labor packages with the unions, you know, and also are pushing a product that is familiar, backed up by tons of advertising, that is using unsustainable practices, which makes sure that the price of the product is you know, artificially lower than it should be. Those businesses are actually, they could easily take a hit to their numbers. You know, they could easily sacrifice a quarter of a percent of their margin to make a statement that appeals to the community. Whereas when you're asking that of a food co-op, they're already paying, you know, $45,000 a year for somebody to work in the grocery department, you know, to do buying, you know, and to ask a food co-op to get behind your cause and have that cause be to take products off the shelf, you're asking them to sacrifice, you know, capital for their employees, and then also, you know, their value image. So, you know, I see, I mean, personally, I feel that a food co-op should take political stances. I think that time and time again, case studies have come out where it hasn't hurt the business, and it's satisfied a moral need for your community. And you know, I would urge them to all co-op boards to seriously consider what they're asking. And you know, if anything, if ultimately they hold a vote and the vote doesn't pass, you know, that would be fine. That would be a fine conclusion, because at least then on paper, you know, this is what the Democratic decision was. If there was no vote held and it was expected to be some sort of management decision, and management decided to stay with the product and continue offering, you know, Eden Foods despite their advocacy against women's contraceptives, you know, I think that nobody really does that lightly as a manager. I think that they're making that decision based on, you know, what they see is really best financially for the business. And, you know, what happens, I think, because, and this is a phenomenon you'll find with any business that tries to associate itself with what would be a good progressive cause, they're heavily criticized. I mean, organic grocery stores, you get constant, almost on the level of harassment, you know, mention. But there's, you know, tons of emails and critical phone calls coming in.
You know, seeing it online that everyone who had, well, not everyone, but it, you know, just seemed to be that everybody who had a very personal political stance against something and who had a membership card was demanding why the cooperative was not making an official statement, you know, taking a stance about the, you know, these particular things that weren't necessarily related to food.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's, you know, it's a very difficult place to be because they are, you know, they're all activists in food justice. And because of that, everybody brings every single social cause to their table. And I'm not saying, you know, I think that's great. I think that's one of the roles of the food co-op, to provide community meeting spaces. So people even have a space to organize where they don't have to pay, you know, $30 an hour to get access to Wi-Fi and a projector. You know what I mean? Like, all that stuff is so important. And again, personally, I feel like food co-ops should go out on a limb and ban some products, you know, if their membership decides that they don't want it sold. And, you know, all this, though, all those people that had cards at the food co-op that were demanding them to take down a product, there's one very easy solution that the system already accommodates, and that is you don't buy it personally. You tell your friends why you're not buying it, you know? And the quickest way to get a product off the shelf at any store is to stop buying it. So there's always that option. And so what happens, though, is the people want to take the shortcut. They don't want to do the hard work of organizing their membership and their community to understand the nuances of this issue and why perhaps, you know, they want them to ban, you know, a soda manufacturer from Israel, you know, even though they're the only natural product, you know, soda, like kit, you know, to make your own. You know, so instead of taking the hard time to explain, show the proof how this directly hurts people in Palestine and the, you know, dehumanization of those people there, instead they start complaining to management, you know. And here's the other thing. This is just another, you know, study in how human behavior, the easiest way to get somebody to turn you off is to start complaining. The quickest way to get somebody to listen to you is to act. So, you know, it's not enough to stand there and demand that your food co-op stop selling something. You should be organizing, but if you think that, you know, an isolated phone call or email, you know, chain is going to do the job, you know, you're asking too much from the managers, you know, the managers that have to ensure that they're paying 50 people every 2 weeks and, you know, that they're paying their vendors so they don't lose their credit with them, you know, that ensure that this food supply of good, clean food is going to your community. And what you're asking them is to balance that business with a, you know, social justice campaign of some sort. So I think, you know, the responsibility shouldn't lie with managers. It shouldn't lie with the board of directors. It should lie with the people that are bringing the issue up. And if they're not willing to do the hard work of creating a coalition, then it's not going to go anywhere.
Digital high def propaganda brought to your video, radio, satellite, aerial, live broadcast, live analog stereo, straight to your barrio, neighborhood block, thoroughly infiltrate the borough like rock, cocaine, choke brain, virus in your domain, media projection, fill your wig like Rogaine, Ayatollah Khomeini, fast in the slow lane, imagery brought to you by worldwide industry, shaping your identity, determine your tendencies, conquer the human race, teach them that they're enemies, subliminal white supremacy, Glenn Beck and Sean Hannity project the fantasy. Secret societies enslave humanity. Fox News is vanity. Check the analysts. Patched on the screen, screaming at the panelists. Prepare for battle is the message I've received since Obama was the catalyst. It's hard not to believe. Race hatred is the culprit, but deep beneath the surface, I detect an ulterior motive. The atmosphere is explosive, incendiary. You can't fly without revealing your itinerary. Intelligence agencies now intermarry. Remember, you thought it was temporary, now it's permanent. Satellites launched in the firmament. Restrict the people's circulation like a tourniquet. Some people raise the flag high, son, I'm burning it. They label me a terrorist, I guess I'm earning it. Freedom of speech is just a lie. Because of the words I speak, I could possibly die. But I can't deny what I feel in my chest. best. My rhyme is the vital enzyme. I used to digest the crime I ingest. I spent a lifetime of witnessing injustice. The lessons I've learned in life, my hip-hop addresses and transgresses the status quo. Expose the mass media apparatus, roots radical. I'm apropos, or should I say I'm relevant? The litmus test that identifies the element behind the compound producing what you think matters. Through sequential persuasion that they link at us, stream at us on our homepage. Manipulators through visual imagery, it's the clone age. Talk radio is instigating road rage. Codified conversation that is opaque, so vague most people don't get the xenophobia that the host transmits. It might as well be Sanskrit, the way the people repeat the scripts and chants like it's tantric. Politicians turn fanatic with their antics. AK-47s picking signs, pamphlets. The crowd becomes frantic when they mention certain keywords at their rallies and conventions. Reminiscent of a lynching, the purpose and intention is the same, cause the tactics never change. Inflame the population, let them blame one another while the corporations run the operation. Steady inoculation, so we say vaccinated. To enslave the masses, keep the asses fascinated.
This is Malachi Daniels, talking to you from New York City. You're listening to Aboriginal News, Angry Indian Radio, a place where you can come to hear what's really critical and discussed about African people, about indigenous people, what is going on globally, where you can come and get real information. This is not CNN. This is not even RT or STV. This is Aboriginal News. Come and get it.
I'm going to stand until I can't stand no more, if I have to stand by myself.
The American people are the last people to wake up.
Prisons are becoming an integral part of the U.S. economy.
People of color organize critical thinking, strategic work, and direct action for social, racial, gender, and economic justice.
A world run by a handful of greedy bankers and CEOs who nobody elected can't possibly last.
People of Color Organize features intersections of race, politics, feminism, movement, class, internationalism, and theory.
This is about the Black Panthers. This is about the American Indian movement. This is about all of us.
Visit us online at peopleofcolororganize.com. Follow us on Twitter at POC Organize and Facebook at facebook.com/peopleofcolororganize. You can also find us on Tumblr at peopleofcolor.tumblr.com.
We're organizing against what we term genocide.
Hey everybody, it's Dr. Vibe, the host and producer of the Dr. Vibe Show at thedrvibeshow.com. At our show, we do conversations and provide information for Black men and those who love them. So come check us out. Also at iTunes, and also selective episodes are featured at the Good Men Project, one of the most viewed websites in the world for men. So find out about Black men and those who love them at the Dr. Vibe Show.
Go on, chillin'. That's what we're to talk about. We need a little help. Can't do this y'all alone. Thank God for this. Lick. Jim Brown, y'all. Yes, this your evening. One more time. We're to ask one of the chillin' for get up. Get into it. Get involved. Oh, Hunter Chillin, when I have to come down here to the Gullah Geechee Nation, and so glad that Hunter to tune in to we Gullah Geechee Rhythm Radio Station. Hunter Chillin, no, this year the head from the body of this year nation and the whole of we station. Queen Quest, come on, Chillin, get involved, get involved, get involved to the Gullah Geechee Sea Island Coalition, the sponsor of this year radio station. Hunter Chillin, this year the we show, Gullah Geechee Rhythm Radio. Come on, y'all.
Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid from The Horn, headonradionetwork.com, and you're listening to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
All right, so, you know, now that we discussed, you know, that from the member owners, and in terms of the people who actually function in these places to try to keep them running, you know, you have a lot of frustration that I'm hearing from a lot of workers and cooperatives that, you know, as we kind of broke into earlier, there's a lot of lack of willing to change, to willing to adapt. And in terms of equipment, you know, we're hearing about, you know, many of the internal services that are, you know, the companies that they're sourcing from, which are a limited number from what I understand, in terms of the type of POS systems, for example, that they use, the accounting, the inventory systems that they use, scanners, that they're not at all up to date with what's going on. And it's actually cheaper in, like, say, what's being used by maybe a Costco. So, you know, as somebody who works in the tech sector, that, you know, how does that end, or how does that lead into the bottom line of a cooperative? And what is the value of open source? Now, we hear about open book management, but what in terms of open source, you know, sourcing for software, equipment, systems that would, say, reduce the bottom line in terms of operating costs for a lot of these cooperatives?
There's tons of open source options out there, and open source means that you have the rights to tweak the system, you know, edit the source code, change what's there, make something new as a derivative work of their software. And it frees you from paying licensing fees. So there is a push to use more open source in the food co-op sector, definitely from me and from other people I've met, and definitely from the MountainViewMarket.coop, which uses Drupal, which is a freely available open source web architecture system, as their platform for their website, and is you know, looking into ways of expanding that into other systems at their store, you know, especially inventory and point of sale. So the dilemma is, it takes a significant investment to customize these systems for grocery stores. And then that's why you find, you know, vendors out there that have made these custom installations, and then they're selling licensing fees. You know, they're selling seats. You got Catapult, which is an inventory management ordering system, which is, you know, you have to buy a key that plugs into your Windows PC, which is the only thing it operates on. And, you know, they sell you a USB key that has a data file on there that the program won't even operate without that key plugged in. So, you know, that those are the systems that are free, or that are most likely available. And because you can always, you know, pay their licensing, you open a new store, you got to pay them like $5,000, you know, for a POS system. You got to pay another $5,000 for the equipment. And that's $10,000. But to create your own POS system from what's freely available in open source, because typically with open source, it is, you know, it's off the shelf. It's not totally customized to exactly what you need. Almost times that amount of a $10,000 licensing fee. You know, about $50,000 to fully customize the POS system and ensure that it's stable and, you know, easy to maintain as, you know, other parts of the system get updated down the road. So it's not cheap. And that's what happens is, you know, when you're running a business that's on slim margins.
When you develop these systems for these cooperatives, why doesn't someone like you develop an accounting system, point of sale, registry, you know, the cashier, what have you. Why doesn't somebody just have a base like that out, like, say, Drupal, which is a web design architecture? Why isn't that already out there in the open source world and available to the cooperative industry?
There are options. There's one called Drupal Commerce POS, and then there's also UberPart POS, which runs on Drupal. And I believe the UberPart POS was actually for some reason, I'm thinking like a co-op in New Hampshire was actively working on that, like when I looked into it about 3 years ago. So, you know, there are people out there that do build these starter packages and put them on, you know, the Drupal servers for you to freely download in the co-op movement. The problem is that every co-op actually has its own unique needs, and a lot of times to get these systems to meet those needs, it takes a significant amount of development. And, you know, currently I am actively involved in creating this. The biggest problem is capital for it. You know, if I could get together a group of food co-ops that want to invest in a open source point of sale inventory online ordering system, I could make it happen.
So these things can be done open source without having to pay the licensing fees to, say, Microsoft.
Yeah.
So, you know, and why aren't more shops using these options that are following a cooperative model? Because as far as the Rorschach's principles go, that is where cooperatives should already be. As soon as it became stable, they've already should have started, started using these things. I mean, if you have a cooperative that has 10 computers, and say if you want to maintain some kind of integrity because Windows has support through Microsoft Office when you buy the licensing. Okay, so you have the two main computers that really need it. But for everybody else that's doing their routine dailies, why are they not using OpenOffice as an option or some of the others? Because there's plenty now,
you know,
with Microsoft.
Yeah.
Which, again, makes me have to ask, as a member owner, why would you want to continue to use a company, especially if we're going to get political, like Microsoft, to rely on them, you know, for so many of your computers and so many of your running programs, when you can use something else and not have to pay these fees? I mean, how many thousands of dollars could the average cooperative in the United States save if they were using open source, at least for the, you know, for the supplemental, you know, work that needs to be done on a daily?
Yeah, you know, it probably totals up in your average grocery store. I'd say they have about 20 computers. That doesn't include point of sale. You know, that's for buyers, managers, you know, employees' use. And then you have a bunch of point of sale, which a lot of times are actually still DOS systems in food co-ops. So, like DOS, you know, the old, it's not even Windows a lot of times. So, you could probably save, just a rough calculation, I'd say at least $5,000 a year when you're talking about having to run a licensed copy of Windows, and then also the paying for a premium virus, antivirus utility, you know, which Linux has, you know, A, not many viruses, if any, and then B, freely available, robust,
the U.S. military, to some degree, I understand, is using Linux.
Yeah.
The government is using Linux. The entire government, it's the law there, I understand, in Brazil, that they're all using Linux, which caused Microsoft to fly some people down there to try to talk them out of it, because they took all of the government computers off of Microsoft. And they're now using Linux systems, which is a great idea. And I believe Argentina is also moving that way with large parts of their government structure because they realize that, one, it's a lot more secure. And, you know, for many in the economic sector, that is just one less license that they have to pay.
Yeah, I think the rate of adoption you're seeing in the food co-ops, it unfortunately matches the overall population. You know, I think it probably ties into this idea that I put it forward, where a lot of times they're over-focused on stability. So they're not as innovative as they could be. And it definitely shows in the adoption levels. What's nice about Mountain View Market, you know, they actually have decided to invest in a large screen Macintosh for employee use, so employees can do like virtual meetings together in front of the Mac and stuff. And you know, I think it definitely would have saved money if they went Linux, but you know, it's really just these people are not, you know, they're not in the tech sector. They're not technology enthusiasts always. Many are, but most people are more concerned about food, you know, organic food.
Co-ops. I don't care where I go. If I'm in Portlandia, if I'm in Seattle, doesn't matter where I go. You know, because they look at what's happening with Trader Joe's and then they kind of look at you. And they're like, well, why should we change? What is the point in changing? I'm very comfortable with the GUI I'm using. I'm very comfortable with, you know, Microsoft. I can always give them a call. And, you know, these tech fellas are telling me that they're really, really frustrated because they don't know how to get it across to people who, like you said, are not necessarily techies. They check the email and they watch YouTube at home, but they're not really understanding what he or she needs to do to be able to make things smoother for them, to keep things in the 21st century so that all of this stays relevant. I mean, what would you say to those people?
Yeah. Well, there's a couple of things I do. You know, the first one is I constantly push back against people not branding themselves as Linux. Because, you know, when we're talking about Linux, you know, there's, you know, probably 20, 30 million people in the U.S. right now carrying Linux around in their pockets.
Yeah, they don't know that. Yeah, yeah.
When it's installed as an Android phone on their smartphone. And yeah, they don't understand that, you know. So the sad thing is, because it's like this, you know, open source project, Linux has been able to be co-opted and rebranded as Android. It's been able to be rebranded as Chromebook. You know, Chrome operating system, that's a Linux operating system. And that's the place I first start. When I start bringing up, well, why don't we try, you know, installing Ubuntu Linux and running OpenOffice to do your, you know, spreadsheets and communication, you know, stuff, email, whatnot, and your web browser. And they say, well, what's that? You know, that sounds ridiculous. I say, well, you know, what kind of phone do you use? If they say Android, game over. Well, you're relying on Linux to power your smartphone, why not, you know, use it on your desktop computer? So that's one of the, you know, things that I do to at least help educate people, and it has helped. The other thing is, you know, I think we just, in many ways, need to be patient that as this is progressing, as long as you're constantly putting the option out there to go open source and free yourself from licensing fees, you know, you're doing your job, and eventually that option is going to get on the table.
They understood the concept, though.
I have full faith in that, especially like when you're looking at, you know, the food co-op Mountain View Market, when they wanted to do their website, you know, their board was emphatic that they wanted it to be open source. You know, they understood open source. There, you know, there was definitely the board president there. You know, Paul is very much a technology enthusiast, and you know, he's been using Linux for years. So, you know, there are people out there. They're probably, that is not the typical experience. The typical experience is the one you're describing. But we were able to do an open source website, you know, based on Drupal. And that's still powering, you know, that's still there. We've kept it updated. It's been very stable for them. You know, that's been chugging along for 3 years. So that's an example of a co-op that did adopt open source for one of their systems. And as that exists as a success story for them, it's slowly going to trickle into these other systems. You know, they're going to be able to question their point of sale choices. When they do open a new store, you know, hopefully in El Paso, they'll you know, be able to look at, you know, well, this is our budget to open the store. You know, isn't it time for us to consider investing and finishing the development of, you know, an open source point of sale system for our needs? And because they have a website that's been running for 3, 4, 5 years with no major hitches, you know, that's going to be an option for them. Whereas 5 years ago, you know, it was
that is
it probably what, you know, they wouldn't even consider it. So I think it's just, it's a slow, I think, I've heard Ubuntu now is on 3% of desktop computers. And, you know, to me, that
is actually
tremendous.
In the scheme of things,
You know, in the scheme of things, you know, that, and that's one brand. You know, that doesn't even count the other desktop operating systems out there, you know. So I think with any sort of grassroots social movement, which open source definitely is, you've got to give it time. You know, like, I mean, the food co-op started in the 60s. You know, they were definitely there beforehand, especially for farmers cooperatives, which is, you know, the other side of it. But, you know, the modern food co-op concept definitely came to form in the 60s. And it's taken us 50 years to get to be, you know, a $3 billion industry. Linux, you know, came out in the late 80s and, you know, basically early 90s. You know, so you're talking, we're only just approaching wide adoption, you know, and even though they're already, I don't know for certain, but I would probably theorize they're much bigger than $3 billion already, because it already powers the internet. You know, almost every server online is already Linux. So you just got to give it time. And that doesn't mean that you need to sit back and be patient. You know, it still means you have to be active and making sure that every single interaction you have with people that make decisions for your businesses and your co-op, that they are aware of these other options and that they already rely on them.
Most folks have told me they've never heard of it. And if they knew that it was an option, then they would have thought about that before they purchased their last computer or something, you know. And even though I tell them they can still switch, you know, it's just, you know, we're not aware of it. But, you know, as I was saying to you when we were, you know, warming up for this, there are so many Republican / Libertarian / laissez-faire capitalists that use and love Linux, but hate the idea of welfare, hate the idea of, you know, anything that doesn't sound like subsidy that gives 10 cents to the poor. But they will snap up all the freeware, all of the open source software, all of the operating systems. They use all of the free blogs to spread their nonsense. They use Twitter, you know, all of these things. And I've just always felt, to me, on principle, that a cooperative should be using cooperative means in which to, you know, to do their business.
Yeah.
And when you tell me here that the other cooperative businesses, because I'm Rebel Capitalist has also mentioned the same thing to me, that they're using very old computer systems. And when XP went out, that was a thing about a lot of banks, that they were still using, you know, mainstream banks were using XP. So if cooperatives are still using, I'm not cooperatives, but credit unions are still using DOS.
Yep.
Come on. Yeah, and what's going to happen to that firm when people switch over?
Yeah. Well, no, that was the food co-ops, the major player in the point of sales is a DOS-based point of sale system. You know, that's probably the go-to option that food co-ops use. You know, much lower than what it takes to really invest in a different system. Everybody just keeps choosing to, you know, pay the piper, basically. Instead of breaking off, you know, banding together and really cracking this nut and getting, you know, a food co-op created and operated, you know, point of sale system. And again, I think all we need is time. you know, you give us enough time and we are going to change these realities. And you know, we've already come a long way in many respects. You know, even have like Mountain View Market know that they need to provide online ordering. You know, that right there is a huge innovation that I don't see coming from most food co-ops. But, you know, if people would support them and their cause and even consider, you know, if you don't have a food co-op to support, you could start supporting their food co-op and shipping, you know, great vitamins and supplements, then that would be a case study that comes out as a success. And then once you have that successful case study, you can go and show it at these different conferences where food co-ops come together, you know, and that's how these changes will happen. It's because too many people are still getting by playing it safe. And the person that is the co-op that's taking a risk and being innovative, doesn't have a long enough track record yet of that success. But, you know, once we reach that point, it's going to fall in line. You know, there's definitely going to be a major revolution in the food co-op industry where, you know, I could definitely see wider adoption. And, you know, the unfortunate thing is right now playing it safe is the ideology that's winning. And I think if you give us enough time, you know, the other guests you have and other people like us, you know, we're going to have that innovative environment established that, you know, you see in Europe and other places. You know, real quick, I guess, before I go, you did bring up Europe a couple times. I think the main difference is food cooperative businesses in the United States seem to be so overly focused on what that business is. You know, if they're a food co-op, that's all they are. They're a food co-op. They're not a bank. They're not a auto dealer. You know, they're not all these other things. They're not a travel agency. You know what I mean? Whereas in Europe, I don't know, you know, I haven't studied it hard enough, but for some reason, a co-op in Europe has no problem scouting out another business to launch, even if it has nothing to do with their original business, you know, over the concept of, you know, their main goal is just return value to their members. So that's why, like in England, you have, you know, the co-op, and the co-op runs, you know, food co-ops, it runs, you know, online shopping, you know, it runs the travel agencies, you know, it's offering banking options. You know, like, in the end, that's one humongous cooperative with many different facets underneath it that, you know, provide these different services. So that's just another reason to get involved at your food co-op, because your immediate goal is for healthy food options in your community and, you know, a sustainable business to support. Kitchen concept is, you know, it's a breakfast and lunch destination and it closes in the early evening. But what it does is it fits the needs of, you know, busy commuters and you know, regular business people. They're located near your job. You might have an hour lunch break, maybe less. You can run there and you can get a really healthy lunch. You know, no hamburgers on the menu. You know what I mean? Like, you go there and you get a real hearty meal with, you know, organic ingredients, you know, prepared by a person that's making a living wage. That doesn't, you know, that gets to go home at 6 p.m. and doesn't have to, you know, go to another job. So there is these innovations taking place. Mountain View Market, I think, is probably one of the best examples of a food co-op that's trying to innovate their way forward. And, you know, definitely look for that, you know, and Look at Mountain View Market, look at Greenbelt Food Co-op, look at Glut Food Co-op. And if you want to bring something like that to your community, reach out to me on Twitter at Mathematic. Reach out to, you know, many of the, there's organizations out there that's all they do is help organize food co-ops. You know, there's tons of people trying to improve conditions in your neighborhood that could be a resource for you. You know, there's a lot of shortcuts you could take to get it happen. You know, sometimes the process is viewed as being too long. You know, but if you talk to some of these, you know, more experienced people, you could figure out ways of making things happen much more quick. And I think it's all about deciding where you're spending your money in the end. You know, beyond voting, you know, I vote every single election, but I do not spend my time volunteering for politicians. You know, I do cover their stuff on social media. I share stories. You know, I definitely, you know, scapegoat Republicans because they deserve it so much. But the, you know, I recognize that it can't end at the voting booth. That, you know, you're electing these people that then have to go and be swayed with multitudes of cash, you know, with campaign donations, and that's who you're competing with. You know, you're voting, but you know your representation is in competition constantly with extremely wealthy organizations and individuals. So that's why when I spend my time, you know, if I do volunteer, it's for a food co-op. You know, it's for a community-owned business. You know, you know, that's why my focus is always on helping people organize that, make sure they're successful and you know, prepared for the future. Because to me, that's more important than voting. If where you're spending your money supports cheap labor and, you know, even slave labor overseas, you know, if you're, that's where you're spending your dollar, then that's what you're supporting. You know, if where you spend your dollar, it's supporting gainful employment in your community, it's supporting.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I hope, you know, somebody who is listening to this really steps up and takes his challenge to, you know, if you work in a food cooperative, you belong to a food cooperative, if you feel that they're not really moving up because they just don't know what to do, they don't know where to go, get in contact with him. We're going to make sure that this information is with the other data along with this dispatch. And, you know, Mathematic, thanks again, man, for being on, for, you know, bringing, you just laid down a lot of knowledge, and I really hope people take, you know, take this and really go with it, because I want to see food cooperatives do more. I want to see food cooperatives in the black community. I want to see food cooperatives in the native community. We need to be able to eat well.
Yeah.
Because if we're not, we're not going to be able to deal with what's coming down. All right. So, you know, Matt, thanks again, man, for being on.
Thank you.
Check them out. This is Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Please stay tuned.
Mutual aid, universal tolerance, and the individual supreme. At heart, George, I've discovered I'm an anarchist. Man is born free, but is everywhere in chains.
Dance to ya, kakioni wakuma kante. Winston Wataninia, Miksuachi, Saskatchewan, Ocean.
I am Winston Watini. I am from Mik, Saskatchewan. Knowledge is power. We must gather knowledge to protect our children, our culture, our future. Learn the ways you can protect yourself and others from infection and spreading HIV. Teach others what you have learned. Together, we can make a difference.
Yo, what's up? My name is Jasiri X, you know what I'm saying? And I'm
really responding to the call, man, of my sister Rosa Clemente, you know what I'm saying, for Men in Hip Hop, really stand up and say, like, rape under no circumstances is acceptable, you know what I'm saying? Rape shouldn't be rapped about, it shouldn't be supported, you know what I'm saying? And I'm really feeling like, you know, especially after Rick Ross came out today and said what he said, you know, he didn't use the word rape, but he described a scenario in which, you know, he put something in a woman's drink and had sex with her, and she didn't consent. If you have sex with a woman and she didn't consent, that's rape. And we have to say no to rape. And beyond Rick Ross, whether it's Fox News or their viewers attacking Zelina Maxwell for asking men to stop raping women, whether it's Hollywood, you know, perpetuating, you know, this rape culture, you know, it's got to stop. It's really, you know, we got to take personal responsibility as men. My name is Jasiri X. This is One Hood.
तपाईलाई थाहा छ नेपालमा पहिलो पटक कहिले एचआईभी संक्रमित व्यक्ति फेला परेको थियो
थाहा छ सन् 1988 मा
यतिका वर्ष बितिसक्दा एचआईभी एड्सको क्षेत्रमा के भए सकारात्मक परिवर्तनहरू कति आए कसले के गरे
के हामीले आफ्नो जिम्मेवारी बहन गर्यौं तपाईले गर्नुभयो
जवाफ आफैसँग खोजौं जिम्मेवारी बहन गरौं
सामाजिक रूपान्तरणका लागि गगन गृहको एउटा प्रयास
Staff of life on the table of his holy word, there's always, always a table filled for a king. Plates heaped with hope. And faith and golden cups brimming with charity. Well, didn't he say, feast on, oh my Lord, oh my God, bring me your hungry souls. Feast on me, well, oh my God, bring me your hungry souls, sit right down and feast on me. Now didn't he turn the waters to wine and make those old Feast on me, my God, oh my Lord, bring me your hungry souls, sit right down and feast on me. Oh yes, he opened wide his arms to sit right down and feast on me.
And we thank thee, amen.
This is Kristen Hirsch from Throwing Muses, and you're listening to a podcast released under a Creative Commons license.
This is DJ Fusion of the Fuse Box Radio Broadcast and BlackRadiosBack.com, and you're now listening to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio, another slice of real black radio for the masses. All right? Peace.